This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Kremlin's Candidate by Jason Matthews. Read by Jeremy Bob.
Prologue, The Metropole. September 2005. Despite the velvet-flocked gold-leaf splendor of the Metropole Hotel, the enduring fetor of Moscow clung to the drapes and lay thick on the carpet, an incense of fusel oil, boiled cabbage, and ruined pussy. 24-year-old Lieutenant Dominika Igorova of the Sluzhba Veshni Razvedki, the SVR, the External Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, stood in her underwear, black lace from Walford in Vienna, and looked down at the naked woman on the bed, snoring on her back, a feral, protruding incisor visible in her open mouth. The American woman, her name was Audrey, had been a biter. Dominika looked in the smoky gilt mirror at the purple half-moon bite mark on her shoulder, the irregular notch from Audrey's snaggle tooth clearly visible. The 19th-century bed, formerly from the Pavlovsk Palace in St. Petersburg, had a soaring rococo canopy framed in falls of musty satin and faded silk ropes. The twisted sheets under Audrey's tall, bony body were darkly wet in a wide circle. Besides the biting, there had been the throaty grunts, more characteristically heard from boars in the thickets of the Smolensk hunting preserve. Audrey was what they called a kruknut in Sparrow School, a screamer in bed. Loud, but nothing to faze a voroboy, a sparrow, a state-trained courtesan sent to the gabled mansion on the Volga River that was the secret state school for, sent to learn the art of sexpionage. Sexual entrapment, carnal blackmail, moral compromise, all with the aim of recruiting susceptible human targets as clandestine intelligence sources, targets who had been maneuvered into an intricate Polovaya Zapadnya, an SVR honey trap. Dominika looked at the horse bite on her shoulder again. Suka, bitch. How she loathed being a sparrow. How low she had sunk. 2 years ago, the world had been hers for the taking. She had been destined for the Bolshoi as a future prima ballerina, until a rival had broken Dominika's foot, resulting in the abrupt end of a nearly 20-year ballet career and a permanent slight hitch in her gait. The following year had been a nightmare descent into wanton indenture. To keep her ailing, widowed mother in their state-provided apartment, she let her uncle, then deputy director of SVR, coerce her to sleep with a man, a repugnant oligarch whom President Putin wanted eliminated. To keep her quiet after the assassination, Uncle Vanya had magnanimously admitted her into the Andropov Institute, the Forest, the SVR's foreign spy academy, where Dominika found to her astonishment that she had a natural aptitude for spook work and, consequently, she hoped, a new future serving the Rodina, her motherland, as an intelligence officer. Her fluent French and strong English learned at home in a house full of books and music were attributes. She had the skills, the ideas, the imagination, and great expectations for operations in the foreign field. Ah, what a prostodushny. A guileless naïf she had been. The service and the Kremlin and Novorossiya, Putin's new Russia, were still the preserve of men, namely the Siloviki, the myrmidons around the blue-eyed new czar, Vladimir Vladimirovich. These weasels purloined the patrimony of Russia and spread a blanket of corruption so completely over the land that if you were not a billionaire running the energy monopoly Gazprom out of your pocket, then you were a Muscovite, who could not afford meat more than 3 days a week. The Siloviki were the inheritors of the Grey Cardinals, the sclerotic members of the old Soviet Politburo, who had starved Soviet Russians for 70 years with their ineptitude as implacably as this new crowd had been starving modern Russians for the last 20 years with their avarice. After graduating with top marks, Dominika Igorova had basked in the signal achievement that she was now an Operol Nomochoperunyi, one of the few women SVR operations officers. But the sweet Dead Sea fruit of success turned to ashes in her mouth when Uncle Vanya sent her packing to State School 4, the Khan Institute in Kazan, on the banks of the Volga, otherwise known as Sparrow School, where women were taught the unceasing, inexorable, inescapable indignities of learning how to be one of Putin's prostitutes. Part of Dominika's soul died in Sparrow School. Other women literally died. Suicide among the forlorn was not uncommon. The dead parts inside Dominika were replaced by Beshnetsvo, an enduring white fury against the system and a simmering hatred for the Podkalimmi, the toad-eaters surrounding their taciturn sovereign. She was determined to succeed. After Sparrow School and back in Moscow, she did her homework and identified a seduction target on her own, a mild French diplomat whose wife was absent and whose adult daughter in Paris worked in a department of the French Ministry of Defense, which oversaw France's nuclear weapons. Dominika knew the man was falling in love with her, and that he would ask his daughter to whisper to Papa any French Adam secrets that Dominika wanted to know. It was an easy seduction and not altogether unpleasant because he was a lonely, decent man. The difference was that this was a genuine operation. The potential intelligence harvest for the SVR was unparalleled. But the seduction went too well, and Dominika's pot-bellied chiefs were envious, so they willfully and with malice ruined the pitch and spooked the Frenchman. He reported his dalliance to his embassy and was sent home. The case was lost, and Igorova, the blue-eyed upstart academy graduate, was put in her place. Solicitous Uncle Vanya commiserated with her and announced he was going to offer her something that was a real operation, something substantial, something even more desirable because it included being posted abroad in glamorous Finland, he said. This was more like it, thought Dominika, a real operational mission. But one small assignment first. It would take 3 hours, said her uncle, smiling. Seduce an American in the Metropole Hotel. Do this final honey trap for the service, and then pack for your assignment in Helsinki. One last time, she had thought. U.S. Navy Lieutenant Junior Grade Audrey Rowland had been in Moscow for a week with a group of senior students from the National War College on a junket to observe Russian bilateral geopolitics, whatever that meant. As was customary with any official visitors to Russia, on receipt of the students' visa applications months before, SVR targeteers began their research, combed through open-source databanks, and asked clandestine sources in the Pentagon for bios and assessments of the dozen War College students who would arrive in Moscow 6 weeks hence. Running traces was standard procedure. SVR targeteers were like patient wolves on the hillside, watching the horse-drawn troika, filled with drunken kulaks, waiting to see if someone would fall out of the sled insensate into a snowbank and provide fresh meat. Lieutenant Junior Grade Roland's unique profile especially caught their sharp-eyed attention. The targeting study noted that Roland had graduated with a Ph.D. in advanced particle physics from Caltech, had enlisted in the U.S. Navy, and had breezed through officer candidate school, already marked as a fast riser and a sure bet for eventual selection to flag rank. After OCS, Audrey had been assigned to the Electromagnetics Division in NRL, the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C. From a purloined classified technical NRL newsletter, the Russians read that in the first 3 months of her assignment, Audrey Rowland had impressed senior scientists with a monograph on heat diffusion in the MJ-64 experimental naval railgun. This tidbit stirred considerable interest among Russian intelligence circles. U.S. railgun technology was a prime collection requirement of the Russian Navy. The threat of an electrically propelled, powderless projectile with a velocity of 2,200 meters per second and unerringly accurate at ranges beyond 150 kilometers was a concern to Russian naval command. The U.S. Navy had put it another way. A railgun projectile fired from New York City would score a direct hit on a target in Philadelphia in less than 37 seconds. Because Roland was a potentially attractive target, an extra effort was made to collect what the spook world called lifestyle and personal bio. There was more gleaned from a Russian illegal buried in the administrative staff of the University of California, Irvine, who had access to certain restricted databases in the UC and local law enforcement systems. Posing as an employment investigator, the illegal also interviewed neighbors, landlords, and one former roommate at Caltech. The results were interesting. Roland was solitary, remote, with a weakness for margaritas, after two of which she tended to pass out. Beneath what appeared as a shy exterior was a highly competitive nature. There were unflattering stories about obsessive behavior in the classroom and laboratory. Then, the jackpot. She'd had an abusive father, himself a Navy pilot. There were possible sexual overtones and a complete absence of men during her university years, culminating in an unspecified date rape incident about which no official record existed. Vestal virgin, physics androgyne, or a woman who prefers vacations on the Aegean island of Lesbos? If the last, there could be an opening for a bit of lesbianage during her visit to Moscow. Targeteers noted that Roland would not have been admitted into OCS or the War College, regardless of recent liberalization policies in the U.S. Navy, if her predilections were known. A secret vulnerability. Lieutenant Junior Grade Roland was to tour in Moscow for the week, staying at the Metropole with 12 classmates and a professor chaperone. Word went up the line to the SVR's American department, then to the FSB, Federalnaya Slyuzhba Bezopasnosti Rossiyskoy Federasti, the Internal Security Service, then to the GRU, Glavnoye Razvedyavtelnoye Upravlenye, the Military Foreign Intelligence Service of the General Staff of the Russian Federation. The usual puerile squabbling among these agencies for primacy to target Roland was stilled when the Kremlin ordained that every organization would have a role. The FSB would control the other students and chaperone, the SVR asset would be used for the honey trap, and the GRU would exploit the take. As for the actual recruitment pitch, a Kremlin specialist known as Dr. Anton would be introduced. Big trouble, Dr. Anton. During the students' week in Moscow, FSB watchers noted with interest that Lieutenant Junior Grade Roland seemed to enjoy more than a single after-dinner vodka in the Metropole's ornate Chaliapin bar, invariably saying good night, then sneaking back and drinking long after her fellow classmates retired for the evening. Sergei, a handsome SVR-trained Voronoi, a raven, the male version of a sparrow, was assigned the task of meeting, charming, and eventually bedding the angular beanpole who wore cardigans buttoned to the neck, opaque pantyhose, and sensible flats in sharp contrast to the hotel's usual sea of cantaloupe busts, see-through tops, and Jimmy Choo glitter pumps. When after two nights of Sergei's musky blandishments it became obvious that Roland preferred to swim face down in Veronica Lake rather than be with a man, the targeteers ordered an urgent change. Time was short, and the SVR and GRU were frantic that Roland not slip through their fingers. Roland's Dello Formular, her operational file, was flipped onto Dominica's worn metal desk in SVR headquarters in Yasenevo district in southwest Moscow by a warty, dismissive section chief. He told her to read it, go home, change into something water-soluble, get to the Metropole by 2100 hours, and compromise the American. Dominica's short fuse flared, and she told the pudgy deputy to go to the Metropole himself since it was obvious the target preferred pussies, which in Russian came out significantly more profane. As if he had been listening via a microphone in her cubicle, Uncle Vanya called 4 minutes later, assuring Dominica that this would be the last such assignment. Hereafter she would be an ops officer on assignment in Helsinki, and the sparrow seductions would cease. "Take this assignment. Please don't tell me no," Vanya had said, his voice suddenly edgy. "Your mother would tell you the same thing." Translation, follow orders or your mother with her rheumatoid arthritis and spinal stenosis will be out on the sidewalk by the time the real Moscow winter arrives. 4 hours later, with the tab of sparrow issue Mogadon, a mild benzodiazepine relaxant under her tongue, Dominica sat at the Chilliopin bar next to an already bleary-eyed Audrey Rowland, who looked sideways at the antique Ottoman necklace Dominica wore around her throat, the hammered silver pendants of which were rattling in the deep V of her breasts. "Service at this bar leaves something to be desired," said Audrey, apparently assuming Dominica spoke English. "I thought this hotel was 5 stars. The tumbler in front of her was empty. Dominica leaned close and whispered conspiratorially. "Russians sometimes need a little encouragement," she said. "I know this barman. He can be a bit contrary. We say, upramye, like a mule." Audrey laughed and watched as Dominica ordered 2 ice vodkas that were served instantly and with great deference. Audrey ignored the barman, drank the vodka in 1 gulp, and appraised Dominica with heavy-lidded eyes. She could not know that the barman and 3 other patrons in the bar were all from Line KR, counter-surveillance assets looking for opposition coverage as Dominica moved on the tall American woman. The bar was clean. Audrey was alone. Dominica did not have to work it too hard. A light legend, cover story, that she was a salaried office worker was sufficient and really couldn't afford drinking at the Metropole but once a month. She told jokes about Russian men gently steering the conversation, holding on to Audrey's wrist occasionally, establishing physicality, straight out of the Sparrow Manual. Dominica purposely showed no curiosity about Audrey's work or her Navy career. There was no need to elicit. Audrey showed herself to be utterly self-absorbed and inclined to talk about herself. A narcissist, perhaps, ego will be a button with this one, thought Dominica, who asked what her hometown of San Diego was really like, eyes wide and interested. Audrey said that she was the only child of a naval aviator father and a quiet mother, biographical facts already in her SVR file, then went on at length about growing up a lithe surfing California beach girl, which Dominica suspected was fiction. Audrey was an unmik, a physics geek, and looked it. After the 3rd vodka, Dominica became serious and cocked her head toward the barman. "Russian men, beware of them. Not just stubborn, but mostly bastards, too," she said. Audrey pried the story out of a seemingly reluctant Dominica in stages, drying her eyes with a cocktail napkin embossed with the M logo of the hotel. She eventually told Audrey of her broken engagement with a fiancé who had been unfaithful by sleeping with a cashier who worked at the gum department store in Red Square, a total fiction. "She was a little harlot with hair dyed purple, newly arrived from some rural oblast. How do you say, some unimaginable province," said Dominica. "2 years we were engaged, and it was over in a night." Audrey patted Dominica's hand, incensed at the nameless philandering fiancé. The hook was always more believable by adding incongruously specific detail like the dyed hair. Number 87, "The Short Stories of Pushkin Stir the Imagination," was the relevant tagline, and one of scores memorized at Sparrow School to illustrate tradecraft points. Audrey's eyes searched Dominica's, now expectant and intense. Audrey was moved by the story only slightly less than the high cheekbones and bee-stung lips of the chestnut-haired beauty sniffling beside her. Agreeing that all men were svinya and toasting to eternal sisterhood, Audrey huskily said she wanted to show Dominica her hotel room. Dominica put an elegant finger to her lips and whispered that instead of Audrey's room, they should sneak into the opulent Yekaterina suite on the 4th floor. Her cousin was a chambermaid at the hotel with a passkey. Audrey shivered in anticipation and grabbed her cardigan. Her profound knowledge of electromagnetic physics sadly provided no warning of the curved tail of the scorpion poised above her head. The suite was magnificent, ablaze in gold and green with an imposing red Tombach samovar on an oval Fabergé tea table in the corner of the room. They looked at the furnishings and at each other. Neither said a word. Dominica knew the nectar trap was about to snap shut. She pretended to stare at the frescoes capering across the Baroque vaulted ceiling when Audrey, now in must, stepped up to her, put her hands on her breasts, and mashed their mouths together. Dominika kissed her back, then slowly disengaged, smiled, and poured two flutes of champagne from an ice bucket on the settee. She palmed a tab of Mogadon into Audrey's glass to smooth her out, and pushed a silver platter of pechenya toward her, powdered sugar Russian tea cake stacked high in a snowy pyramid, taking one herself. Audrey did not register the incongruity that Dominika's chambermaid cousin apparently had provided the expensive champagne and delicate cakes along with the passkey. It was too much watching Dominika nibble the pastry with her even white teeth. Audrey's Dutch oven was at a rolling boil, and with trembling fingers she brushed powdered sugar off the front of Dominika's little black dress and pulled her across the salon into the bedroom. The next 30 minutes were filmed by 4 remote-headed infrared lenses and slaved COS-D11 mics, concealed in the ornate acanthus moldings in each corner of the ceiling, operating at 29 megapixels. The feed was being digitally recorded by an SVR technical team in a special utility room down the hotel hallway. Not taking their eyes off the monitors, 2 sweating technicians bundled and encrypted the images, immediately routing them for real-time review to the Kremlin offices of a few relevant ministers, all former intelligence cronies of the president, a half-kilometer away on the other side of Red Square. Watching the live-action feed was decidedly better than looking at Brazilian bikini girls in National Geographic. Tall, ferret-faced, all hip bones and rib cage, with light brown hair styled in a Prince Valiant cut last seen in the 1928 French silent film The Passion of Joan of Arc, Mousy Audrey was a Gordian knot of guilty passion, fumbling awkwardness and anorgasmia, with a tendency to spritz the bed as she vainly chased her elusive release. Thank God, thought Dominika, nothing complicated. Without much effort, she could avoid active participation and instead assume the role of masseuse and bring this bony scarecrow through the 4 corporeal stages of arousal. In school, they called them fog, breeze, mountain, and wave, to coax what the instructors called malankoye shushestvo, the little creature, out of her, which is exactly what happened 30 teetering minutes later, the first shuddering spasm triggered by the unexpected introduction of the ribbed rubber handle of Audrey's hairbrush. Number 89, pray at the back altar of St. Basil's Cathedral. Moaning and wide-eyed, Audrey came off the mattress like a vampire sitting up in a coffin, wrapped her arms around Dominika's neck, sunk her teeth into her shoulder, and rode her successive shuddering orgasms like a witch on a broom, out of the hotel, over the Kremlin walls, past President Putin's bedroom window, and around the star on the spire of the Ukraine Hotel, 200 meters above the Arbatsky bend of the river. That should give the GRU recruiter enough to work with, thought Dominika, with technical aplomb, as Audrey collapsed on her back, sighing. Dominika draped a towel over Audrey's trembling loins. The last time, she thought, and thank God she was leaving this behind. Helsinki was going to be a dream. She couldn't know she was both right and wrong. Audrey was stirring out of her benzodiazepine-fueled 4-climax coma, her head surprisingly clear, her thighs sticky and trembling. As per procedure, the sparrow always slipped out of the room as the recruiter came in, and Dominika shouldered past him, ignoring his courteous nod. Audrey didn't even see her go, and she didn't know that the inveigling sparrow's role was complete. For Audrey, what's her name would be only a fading memory. A Venus with blue eyes holding that hairbrush, albeit immortalized permanently on digital video. Audrey likewise didn't know that the Kremlin recruiter was the renowned Dr. Anton Gorelikov, the 50-year-old director of Putin's mysterious secretariat, a shadowy office in the Kremlin with a single member, Gorelikov himself, that handled delicate, strategic matters of importance, such as the coercive recruitment of a young U.S. Navy officer. Uncle Anton had scored monumental recruitment successes over the years. Speaking in fluent Oxfordian English, Gorelikov had a number of issues to discuss after Audrey finished dressing and came out of the gilt bathroom, nervously combing her hair with the still-hot hairbrush. He rarely used threats, preferring instead to rationally discuss the benefits of cooperating with Russian intelligence and ignoring the unpleasantness that had just concluded. They sat in the salon, Audrey apprehensive but clueless. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. "It's a distinct pleasure to meet you, Audrey," said Uncle Anton. Audrey shifted in her chair and looked at him. Some of her starch was on display. "How do you know my name?" she said. "Who are you?" Gorelikov smiled the smile that had doomed 1,000 blackmailed recruits. Audrey's voice was not calm. He heard the telltale wavering tone. "Please call me Anton," he said. "I know your name because your bona fides are superb. A brilliant career in weapons research ahead of you, excellent prospects for promotion, influential mentors, and powerful sponsors who will supercharge your Navy career." "How do you know so much about me? What entity do you represent?" said Audrey, still not comprehending what this was. Uncle Anton ignored her questions. "As for the brief liaison this evening with the young girl from the bar, it is wisely left unmentioned, best for all concerned," said Uncle Anton. "I greatly admire the wisdom of the U.S. Navy's don't-ask-don't-tell reforms. Sadly, our Russian military is too monolithic for such liberal farsightedness," he sighed. "What's that got to do with anything?" said Audrey, whose exceptional mind was beginning to connect the dots. A cold wave ran down her back. "I have an abiding worry," said Uncle Anton. "I fear that if your sapphic indiscretions become public, the old institutional prejudices in your service regrettably would almost certainly reemerge, putting you at risk of early retirement on the beach at half pay. That would be both unjust and unfair." With prescient timing, Gorelikov pointed the remote at the television in the corner of the salon, which began showing precisely which indiscretions he was talking about, namely images of Audrey's trembling legs in the air with what appeared to be a lemur's tail protruding from between her buttocks. Audrey sat numbly in the armchair, watching, expressionless, giving few psychic clues to the wily old wizard, which was interesting. She was placid, emotionless, acquiescent. She accepted a cigarette and drew on it deeply. Gorelikov knew she was considering the consequences. Good sign. Audrey indeed was considering the consequences. She knew what would happen, as they had been given security briefings on just these situations. She had chosen to ignore them. They were regulations that would not, did not, apply to her. She was going places in the Navy, and she didn't have the time, but she knew she was in a jam. The Russians would concoct a charade. The young Russian girl would come forward, tearfully claiming to the authorities that she was coerced into making a salacious sex tape, which was a violation of at least 6 Russian morality laws. Such a scandal would destroy Audrey's career, this career she had been preparing for since graduate school, through officer candidate school, to the research lab in order to climb the ladder, to outdo her ungenerous father, to best his own accomplishments in the Navy, and to earn the benefits and prestige of flag rank in a service that was the impenetrable preserve of smugly solicitous men. All this will be hers. Nothing was more important. Her physicist's mind leapt ahead with comprehension. "In the simplest terms, you are blackmailing me, an officer of the U.S. Navy." Audrey couldn't keep the tremor out of her voice. Uncle Anton held up his hands in an expression of alarm. "My dear Audrey," he said, "that is the furthest thing from my mind. The very notion repels me." "Then perhaps you'll have the courtesy to tell me exactly what it is you have on your mind." Gorelikov noted that she already could give orders like an admiral. "Gladly," he said. "Enough of hypotheticals. I have an exceptional offer. I would like to propose a discreet relationship between you and a sympathetic Russia to work together for a year toward peaceful global parity, a relationship that would be beneficial to both countries and to all nations. A 12-month collaboration. I ask you to consider, after all, even military research has the avoidance of war as its defining goal, does it not?" She did not move, but he knew she was listening. Audrey assessed his words, he was in a sense right. Audrey's long-suffering mother had lived under the callous weight of her regnant husband for 30 years. She was a kind soul and, well, a love child of the '60s, who danced at Woodstock and believed in global peace, in a world devoid of strife, cruelty, and hate. Audrey's analytical mind knew that such things as railguns did not exist in her mother's Elysian world, but she never forgot her placid words in the quiet months before the tumult when her father came home after sea duty. "But no one can live on world peace alone, can they?" said Uncle Anton, breaking into her thoughts. A discreet relationship would bring other tangible, less abstract benefits, such as a consultant's fee, including a monthly stipend, an alias offshore bank account into which significant deposits would be made regularly, and most important, opekunsky, tutorials for her prepared by Russian military experts, the Northern American Institute, and Kremlin staffers on strategic naval doctrine, weapons design, global forecasts, international political priorities, and economic trends. Never mind that all intelligence services use the fiction of tutorials for their assets as elicitation sessions to extract even more information from their agents while giving nothing important away. With such a start, Audrey Rowland would become the U.S. Navy's rising star in military research, assuring promotion, management of entire R&D programs, and plum Pentagon billets. These kinds of assignments often led to national politics after a military career, the Senate, the Cabinet, even higher. Audrey flicked ash onto the floor. She knew what was happening, yet the rewards were exactly the emoluments she coveted. Gorelikov analyzed her in layers, like turning a baluster on a wood lathe. She was a social narcissist with an inflated sense of herself, a compensating careerist with a deep need for admiration and yet a lack of empathy for others, like her father. She was in a system that made her by definition a sexual misfit. She had been a brilliant PhD student with an orderly mind, now impressing superiors at NRL. She was not by nature reckless or impulsive, and yet she was picking up women in a Moscow hotel bar, clearly ignoring ironclad security practices stipulated for criteria countries, high-security threat nations. Oderinmost and Sobstvennoye, genius clouded by ego, with the albatross of conflicted sexuality heavily around her neck. Indeed, a potent profile in a recruitment candidate. Based on his assessment of her, he doubted she would refuse his pitch and choose to face the consequences. Audrey blew a stream of smoke toward the ceiling, winding up her indignation. "Thanks for the offer, Anton, but go fuck yourself," she said flatly, not looking at him. Gorelikov was delighted. It was just the response he'd been waiting for. Pechenya, Russian tea cakes. Mix butter, sugar, baking powder, and vanilla. Incorporate flour, salt, and chopped almonds until dough holds together. Roll 1-inch balls, place on ungreased sheet, and bake in a medium oven, but not till brown. Roll still hot balls in powdered sugar, let cool, then roll in the sugar again. Chapter 1. A Mole in Their Midst. Present Day. Colonel Dominika Igorova, chief of Line KR, the counterintelligence section in the SVR, sat in a chair in the office of the Athens resident, Pavel Bondarchuk, and bounced her foot, a sign of nettled impatience to those who knew her. Bondarchuk, also an SVR colonel, was chief of the Residentura, and responsible for the management of all Russian intelligence operations in Greece. He technically outranked Igorova, but she had acquired patrons in the Kremlin during her career and a professional reputation that was whispered about over the porcelain telegraph at SVR headquarters, gossip only repeated in the headquarters toilet. Recruitments, spy swaps, gunfights. This Juno had even blown the top of a supervisor's head off with a lipstick gun on an island in the Seine in Paris on Putin's orders. Who was going to pull rank on this fire-breathing dragon, thought Bondarchuk, who was a nervous scarecrow with a big forehead and sunken cheeks. Not that she looked like a dragon. In her 30s, Egorova was slim and narrow-waisted with legs still muscular from ballet. Chestnut hair piled on top of her head framed a classic Hellenic face, with heavy brows, high cheekbones, and a straight jaw. Her hands were long-fingered and elegant, the nails square-cut and unpolished. She wore no jewelry, only a thin wristwatch on a narrow velvet band. Even under her loose summer dress on this spring day, Egorova's prodigious 80D bust was obvious, the subject of inevitable frequent comment in Yasenevo hallways. But this was nothing compared to her eyes that held his as she watched him look at her chest. Cobalt blue and unblinking, Egorova's eyes seemed to look inside one's head to read thoughts, a decidedly creepy sensation. What no one knew was that Dominika Egorova could indeed read minds. It was the colors. She was a synesthete, diagnosed at age 5, a condition her professor father and violinist mother made her swear never to reveal, ever, to anyone. And no one knew. Her synesthesia let her see words and music and human moods as ethereal airborne colors. It was a great advantage when she danced ballet and could pirouette among spirals of red and blue. It was a bigger advantage in the hated sparrow school when she could see the gassy cloud around a man's head and shoulders and gauge passion and lust and love. As she entered the service as an operations officer, it was a super weapon she used to assess moods, intentions, and deceptions. She had lived with this ability, a blessing and a curse, picking out the reds and purples of constancy and affection, or the yellows and greens of ill will and sloth, or the blues of thoughtfulness and cunning, and only once the black bat wings of pure evil. Bondarchuk's yellow halo of craven bureaucratic panic pulsed around his shoulders. "You have no authority to initiate an operation in my area of responsibility," he said, twining his fingers nervously. "To pitch a North Korean is doubly risky. You have no idea how these jinyenni, these hyenas, will react. Diplomatic protest, cyber attack, physical violence, they're capable of anything." Dominika had no time for this. "The hyena you refer to is Ri Soo-young, academician Ri, deputy of the Yongbyon Nuclear Scientific Research Center in North Korea, the institution that is working diligently on designing a nuclear warhead to use against the United States. We need a source inside their program. With Chinese encouragement, the North Koreans are as likely to launch a missile at Moscow as at Washington in the next 5 years. Or perhaps you disagree." Bondarchuk said nothing. "I sent you the operational summary. Ri has been at the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, in Vienna for a year," said Dominika. "Never a wrong step, unwavering loyalty to Pyongyang, politically reliable. Then he mails a letter. He wants to talk to Moscow. Conscience, despair, defection, we shall see. In any case, calm yourself. This is not a coercive pitch. He called us. You burned a perfectly good safe house from my list for this unknown target with no guarantee of success," said Bondarchuk. "Complain to Moscow if you wish," snapped Dominika. "I'll deliver your written demarche personally to the director, explaining you would have met the target openly on the street." Dominika's foot bounced like a sewing machine. The man was an imbecile among imbeciles in the service. "We have 2 days to soften him up. This is a furtive weekend away from his Vienna security detail. He's at a beach house in Vula with a housekeeper cook," she said. Bondarchuk sat back in his swivel chair. The so-called housekeeper, the 25-year-old Romanian student, she wouldn't happen to be on your payroll? Dominika shrugged. "One of my best. She's already provided useful insights into his midlife crisis," she said. Bondarchuk laughed. "I'm sure she's providing other useful insights. You sparrows are all alike," he said, implicitly including her. Dominika stood. "Do you think so? Can you tell we are all alike?" she said, all ice. "For instance, is the woman you're seeing every Thursday afternoon a sparrow from the center, would you say, Colonel?" or just your Greek mistress. Can you guess? And if you refer to me as a sparrow ever again, your own midlife crisis will arrive ahead of schedule. Bondarchuk sat rooted in his chair, his yellow halo quivering, as Dominica walked out. When Dominica arrived at the safe house, academician Ree was out at the weekly street market in Vula, the sun-bleached seaside suburb of Athens on the southern coast, buying produce so his Romanian house-sitter Ioana could prepare lemon meatballs with celeriac, like her mother used to make. Even after a year experiencing the culinary delights of Vienna, Ree's starved North Korean palate still craved meat, vegetables, and rich sauces, and Ioana had been preparing hearty meals for the 2 days since he arrived in Athens after slipping out of Vienna before the start of a long weekend. "We have quite the proper domestic scene here," said Ioana to Dominica, who took off her sunglasses as she entered the little second-floor rented apartment, all whitewashed walls and marble floors with balcony sliders completely open to the balmy sea breeze. "He's a strange duck, separate bedrooms, doesn't want back rubs, and doesn't look at me in my undies. He shops for food I cook, he washes the dishes, then he watches English-language news all night. Devours it." Ioana Petrushka was a veteran sparrow, tall and broad-shouldered, a former volleyball player, fluent in English, French, and Romanian, and with level 4 Russian. She had a degree in Slavistics from the University of Bucharest. She disliked most people, officials, SVR officers, and Russians in general, but worshipped Dominica, who was a sister-in-arms, a former sparrow who treated her as an equal. With her Dacian goddess face, Ioana could have made a fortune in the West modeling, but her cross-grainedness kept her working as an SVR sparrow for Dominica, once whispering that she relished the nuances of seduction in a properly managed honey trap. There was a bit of the predator in her which endeared her to Dominica even more. She was perceptive, educated, irascible, irreverent, and skeptical. Dominica protected Ioana inside the service, kept the philandering colonels and generals away from her, and valued her canny assessments of targets. The two women were friends. Dominica planned to eventually extract her from the sparrow cadre and bring her into the service on a permanent basis as an officer. "Does he mention why he posted the letter to the Vienna Residentura?" said Dominica. "What's he want? Is he going to defect?" "I do not wish to defect," said a voice at the door. They hadn't heard him come in. Ri Su-young carried a brimming plastic string bag from which protruded a head of celery and the leaves of a leek. He set the bag on the kitchen counter and sat down in a chair opposite the women. He was short and slight, dressed in a simple white shirt, slacks, and sandals. He had jet black hair, a ruddy moon face with high cheekbones, and a light mole on his chin, like Chairman Mao. "May I assume your colleague is the representative from Moscow?" he asked Ioana. "I will not ask for names." He turned to Dominica. "Welcome. Thank you for coming all this way to see me. I have information for you." He went into the back room and came back with a creased button-and-string manila envelope and handed it to Dominica. "Please excuse the condition of the envelope. I had to smuggle it out of my office under my clothing, but I hope the contents make up for its disheveled appearance." Dominica emptied a sheaf of pages onto the coffee table. The documents were written in Korean script. They may as well have been in Paleolithic scratchings on cave walls in Lascaux. Ree instantly read Dominica's blank stare and blushed in contrition. "I apologize for the Shosungul, the Korean script, but I know that original scientific documents have more intrinsic value than translated or transcribed ones." This is quite the little perfectionist, thought Dominica, appraising the deep blue halo around his head. A thinker, brilliant, anticipates reactions. "Quite so, Professor," said Dominica. "But a peddler of spurious information might bring documents whose value cannot be immediately established." It was a discourteous suggestion made to gauge his reaction. In the back of her mind, this still could be a North Korean intelligence trap concocted for some inscrutable reason by the infantile mind of the outstanding leader, or whatever they called the butterbean chairman these days. By habit, she and Ioana both subconsciously listened for the crunch of gravel footsteps on the driveway outside. Rhee smiled and clapped his hands.
"Quite right indeed. You are prudent to raise the question," he said. "And we still have not heard exactly why you requested this meeting, or precisely what you are offering, or what specifically you expect in return," said Dominica. "I will answer your questions gladly," said the little man with a little bow. "First, I ask nothing of you in exchange for this information. I have no need for money. I do not want to defect. My family in Pyongyang would be fed alive into a steel-rolling furnace one by one if I was to disappear from my post in Vienna. Second, I offer you intelligence, state secrets, on recent successes in Yongbyon's nuclear program, specifically efforts to construct a reliable trigger to a nuclear device, one that eventually will be sufficiently miniaturized to be fitted atop an ICBM. I will summarize in English what I have provided in these technical reports for your preliminary report to Moscow. Will that be satisfactory?"
"That would be quite satisfactory," said Dominica. "But the third question remains. Why are you doing this? And why offer the information to Moscow?"
Rhee looked Dominica directly in the eyes, his blue halo unwavering, his hands still. She did not detect any deception.
"I chose Moscow because Washington has lost its global gravitas in the last decade. It has become an eagle with no talons or beak. CIA has been politicized and contorted and tends to leak intelligence at the behest of their administration for political gain." He smiled. "Collaborating with an intelligence service that leaks to serve ideologue politicians tends to shorten the life expectancy of its reporting sources. I am willing to run risks, but I am not suicidal."
Rhee wiped his palms on his trousers.
"You ask why? A person can sit silent only so long. Nuclear weapons in the hands of a man-child who calls himself the saint of the sun and the moon would be disaster for our country, for the Asian region, and for the world. I risk my and my family's lives to see that never happens. There is no hope in our country. Perhaps I can bring some hope for the future."
"I admire your conviction, Professor," said Dominica. "Are you prepared to continue reporting from Vienna, from the IAEA? I will not lie to you. The risks will not diminish. But I personally will be responsible for your security."
"Collaborating in Vienna will be significantly more difficult," said Rhee. "There is a cadre of security guards who watch our delegation very closely. We are required to live in the same apartment building, two delegates in each flat, so everyone informs on everyone else. Solitary time is very rare."
"These are difficulties that can be surmounted," said Dominica. "We have much experience in these matters."
With the exquisite timing of a trained sparrow, Ioana stood and walked into the kitchen.
"I will start dinner while you discuss business," she said. "I think a bottle of wine tonight to celebrate?"
Academician Rhee sat beside Dominica on the couch and summarized what was in the reports he had provided, occasionally turning a page over to sketch a simple diagram to illustrate a point. He spoke like a scientist, logically and in an ordered sequence.
"We could talk for weeks about nuclear weapon design development, but in a few words, these papers document that our intelligence service has given our nuclear program certain foreign technology that will enable North Korea to build a more powerful nuclear device and to miniaturize it to fit into the warhead of an intercontinental ballistic missile. If I may, there are three important points. One, our intelligence service, the RGB, the Reconnaissance Bureau of the General Staff Department, is not a global service. They operate regionally or hopelessly insular and generally ineffective. They could never have, under any circumstances, acquired the technology on their own. Two, the technology involves advanced electromagnetic components, heretofore only seen in the development of a U.S. naval railgun, an experimental weapon that can propel a projectile at great speeds over immense distances. Three,
Harnessing the electromagnetic power of a reconfigured railgun will enable Yongbyon to develop what is called a gun-type detonator, slamming two subcritical hemispheres of U-235 together for a uranium fission device in a very short period of time. The technology is relevant because it will also facilitate miniaturization of the trigger to fit inside a missile warhead. Dominica knew this was immensely important. Professor, how soon will the trigger be ready for use in its miniaturized form?
I estimate 6 months, unless there are complications, said Ri. Does North Korea at this time have a missile with sufficient range to reach Washington, D.C., or Moscow?
Those are secrets held by the Army's missile forces of the General Staff. My understanding is that as of today they do not, but in 12 months, perhaps. That is only a guess.
How did the RGB acquire the electromagnetic railgun technology?
Ri shook his head slowly.
That I do not know. We are given plain copies of the research, but we see no original documents or plans. The RGB would never disclose the source of their intelligence. Two things are certain. The stolen technology is authentic. It is accelerating our program, saving us years of research and development.
And the second, asked Dominica,
this science could come from only one place. The Americans have a big problem. They have a mole in their midst.
Ioana's Lemon Meatballs with Celeriac. Mix ground beef, chopped onion, chopped parsley, raw egg, allspice, salt, and pepper, and form into short oblong kebab shapes. Aggressively brown the kebabs, then set aside. Sauté celeriac root cut into matchsticks, crushed whole garlic cloves, turmeric, cumin, cinnamon, crushed fennel seeds, and smoked paprika, stirring on high heat. Return kebabs to pan, add chicken stock, lemon juice, and salt and pepper. Bring to a boil, then simmer until celeriac is tender and sauce is thick. Serve with a dollop of thick yogurt and a sprinkle of parsley.
Chapter 2. Bread in the Oven. 12 years ago, when Lieutenant Junior Grade Audrey Rowland, in the suite of the Metropole Hotel, told Kremlin recruiter Anton Gorelikov to go fuck himself after he had proposed an arrangement by which she would share classified information on U.S. Navy weapons research projects with Russian military intelligence in exchange for cash payments and discreet career assistance, Gorelikov was delighted. In the Handbook of Intelligence Recruitments, this blasphemy was not a refusal. The young woman had not said no, and, more important, she had not indignantly declared her intention to report the pitch to American counterintelligence officials, which would have definitively blown the approach. Her 30-minute dalliance with an SVR Sparrow clearly was a reportable contact that would have had grave consequences for her promising Navy career. Gorelikov assessed that she would be motivated by her desire to keep the episode secret. There was something more, he thought. This young woman was ambitious, and she already had shown herself to be a brilliant researcher in a critical program, a gold-plated skill that would guarantee rapid advancement in a male-dominated U.S. Navy, which clearly was important to her. She also carried some as-yet-undefined baggage regarding men, which perhaps manifested itself in her sexual behavior, even at her young age. Ambition leavened by ego, seasoned by a forbidden taste for tribidism. A potent recruitment cocktail. He had let her consider overnight, in the espionage lexicon otherwise colloquially known as leaving the bread in the oven. When Audrey Rowland the next day archly stipulated that she would limit her reporting strictly to the railgun project, Gorelikov graciously agreed to her condition. He knew the hook was set. Most agents start by declaring moral limits to their treason, insisting on close-ended arrangements, usually limited to a single topic, in exchange for keeping their original transgression secret. What none of them immediately realized was that agreeing to provide any secrets to Moscow multiplied the initial infraction 100-fold, enveloping the agent in the spider's web for as long as the Russians stipulated, or until she lost access, or until her luck ran out, and the mole hunters called her in for the inexorable interviews. Gorelikov knew from long experience that the inevitable outcome, the universal fate of all agents, was that Audrey eventually would be blown by careless tradecraft at the hands of a ham-fisted GRU handler, or more likely, by a CIA source inside GRU who would report the existence of a Russian mole in the U.S. Navy. The goal, therefore, had been to compartment the case and run the asset for as long as possible, extracting as much intelligence as quickly as was secure. Audrey Rowland's survival as a reporting source was not Gorelikov's bureaucratic responsibility, but he told himself he'd rather it be handled by the SVR, a service more adept at handling foreign services, or better yet, by an anonymous illegal, impossible to trace and trebly compartmented. Now the lofty Vice Admiral Rowland, encrypted Magnet, nevertheless had defied the actuarial odds for agent survival. She had been reporting for 12 years. There had been breaks in contact, unsuccessful turnovers to unacceptable new handlers, and a hiatus after a security scare, but she had been on the books for 12 years since her recruitment in the Metropole. Vice Admiral Rowland had, as Gorelikov predicted, long ago become accustomed to the act of espionage. She initially rationalized the treason by telling herself that sharing science with Russia would level the technology playing field, engender mutual confidence, and actually lessen the chance of a Third World War, a conflict no sane person thought would be survivable for either side. She enjoyed the florid notes of thanks and admiration from astonished Russian scientists praising her technical brilliance, just as she reveled in the yearly meetings with Uncle Anton, who was elegant, well-dressed, and urbane, and could discuss art or music or philosophy, as well as the limits of shipborne phased array radar, or the megawatt-generating capacity of the Zumwalt-class destroyer. The relationship between agent and masters matured. As Magnet's performance continued unabated and her reliability ratings remained at the highest level, all services constantly assess their canaries for the first sign of trouble in a case is an anomalous change in intel production. Gorelikov, at Putin's direction, began parallel handling. GRU handled Magnet inside the U.S., although they were little more than mailmen, collecting drops and passing requirements. Gorelikov, however, began meeting Magnet during her annual personal leave, her one break from her otherwise total devotion to the laboratories, special access programs, personnel management, and budget oversight duties that consumed her. Everyone knew that stork-like Admiral Rowland chose rugged, campestral destinations for her solo month-long holiday travels, hiking in Nepal, photo safaris in Tanzania, camping in Jamaica, or kayaking down the Amazon. To colleagues unaccustomed to seeing raw-boned Audrey Rowland in anything but her uniform, vacation photos of her in hiking shorts, boots, cargo pants, or a wetsuit usually raised eyebrows and occasioned muttered comparisons to Ichabod Crane. Meetings with Anton were arranged on the margins of Audrey's exotic vacations, in luxurious rented houses in the nearest large cities to avoid extra travel and incriminating stamps in her passport. The agent's initial delusional rationalization for spying evolved under the philosophical tutelage of Uncle Anton, who sought to keep Audrey motivated. The notion of level playing fields seemed less relevant in the new Cold War of active measures and cyber operations. Anton instead often raised the inequity of the system for women in the Navy, drawing from Audrey's progressively less guarded comments about a childhood clearly and completely dominated by an overbearing father, a rakish naval aviator who cowed his quiescent wife and as much as told Audrey he would have preferred a son. If her father were alive today, Audrey told Anton, he would have to salute her. Anton agreed that women had the same problem in Russia, forced by society, customs, and institutions to let men steal emotional strength away from them. Anton's wry empathy struck a chord in Audrey. What she was doing, passing secrets, meeting furtively, accepting payment from the Kremlin, she was doing for herself, and she was doing it to excel in her career despite the men, despite the system. The growing balance in her center-managed accounts,
She already had $5 million worth of the Kremlin's euros, krugerrands, and uncut diamonds, was further personal validation that this was due her. Anton recognized that the notion of espionage as an engine of Audrey's emancipation was a potent control factor. Additional control naturally came from her sexual appetites. Despite liberalizations in the U.S. armed forces,